It's Radio Free 501c, the podcast of Rogue Tulips Consulting. I'm your host, Cecilia Sopp, and we're so excited to be back for Season 6 and continue bringing you outstanding ideas and thought leaders and different ways of thinking. So don't forget to subscribe because you're not going to want to miss any of it. This week, I'm joined by my guest, Hardy Smith. He's the author of a book we all should be reading, Stop the Nonprofit Board Blame Game. And that's our topic for March 4th, 2024. Welcome to episode 231. Hey, everybody, it's Monday, March 4th, and that means it's time for another episode of Radio Free 501c, brought to you by Rogue Tulips Consulting. I'm your host, Cecilia Sepp. I'm the principal and founder of Rogue Tulips. And to our global audience, wherever you may be, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. And thanks to everybody for joining us for this really important episode. All nonprofit organizations, whether you're a charity, a foundation, a professional society, or a trade association, or maybe you're a soccer league, or maybe you're a group of people who just love cats, but you're required to have a board of directors. That's one of the rules if you want to be a 501c organization. Today's guest, Hardy Smith, is here to talk about his new book, Stop the Nonprofit Board Blame Game. And we're going to dive into what are some of the things Hardy learned in his research and some of the advice he can share with us. But before we do that, Hardy, welcome. You're a first-time guest. Glad to have you here. So would you like to say hello to the audience and tell us a little about yourself?
Well, Cecilia, thank you so very much for having me on your podcast. Any podcast that has crossed the 230 mark is a podcast of very significant relevance. So the staying power that you have shown, the consistency for bringing these important messages is so important. So congratulations for that. And I appreciate a chance to spend some time with you and your audience today. I'm a nonprofit. I'm a consultant and speaker in the nonprofit space. I work with organizations and my primary focus is helping those organizations who want positive, productive, and fully engaged boards. And I'm proud to say author of the Amazon best-selling book, Stop the Nonprofit Board Blame Game.
That's wonderful. I didn't realize it was a bestseller on Amazon. Congratulations.
Yes. Thank you.
That's wonderful. So, and as everybody can see, if you're watching on video, if you are listening, Hardy has an image of his book behind him on screen, and it's exactly what it's called, Stop the Nonprofit Board Blame Game. So it's what's a little bit different about your book, Hardy, is it's from the board member's perspective. So how did you start gathering this information from board members?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you. You're good at this. So the is a consultant and speaker. You know, I'm like you. I'm constantly seeing reports and trends and attending workshops and going to conferences. And I'm hearing other speakers and consultants, and I'm hearing from the leaders in the nonprofit sector. I'm hearing from board members as well, right? And the constant drumbeat of concern, complaints, angst around board members not doing what they're supposed to do. I started thinking, well, why don't they do what they're supposed to do? So I started out on a research project and contacted board members across the country that I had just, you know, been introduced to in my network working nationwide. And just ask them, okay, well, you know, these nonprofit leaders are all saying they're just so frustrated because their board members don't do what they're supposed to do. Why is that? And Cecilia, they told me. And so I got like, well, here's a number one issue. Here's a number two issue. Here's why good board members turn off. Here's the mistakes that board members see organizations making, including not recruiting the right board members. And so I just got deeper and deeper into that. and started identifying these challenges that are pretty much universal, as it right? And then started identifying, well, why do these problems exist? And then what are the how-to solutions based on my experience? And I took advantage of a good network of other resources as well, research information to show here's how you can fix it. Mm-hmm. And that was really what, in all of that research, and workshops and speaking and writing, ultimately led to the production of the book.
You know, and it was very interesting for me to read your book. And I'll admit, I haven't finished it yet, but the part I read really resonated with me. It reminded me a lot of that old strategy game, the game of Go. It just takes a few minutes to learn and a lifetime to master. So it takes us a few minutes to learn what a board is supposed to do, but it takes us our lifetime to figure out how to do it well and do it right. And you identified what was the major underpinning of where the tension comes from between staff and board members. And what was that?
The number one issue, well, number one, to have successful, it's all about relationships. Mm-hmm. So professional staff, board members, and board member individuals. So if you want engagement, if you want a board to really buy into what's going on, it's all about relationships. Mm-hmm. And the board members shared with me that, in their opinion, the number one issue contributing to board members not doing what they're supposed to do, Cecilia, is poor communication. And I go deep into the book about communication and why that's so important. And just a little bit of a teaser, it's not about more communication. It's not more emails, more newsletters. It's about, are you communicating effectively? And I offer the techniques on how to make sure you are. And effective communication, as we know, anyone who's involved in a long-term personal relationship or business relationship, we know the most important, most critical factor is successful communication.
Well, and I am glad that is the underpinning, because since we are the relationship industry, that's really a lot of what we do. We communicate, we build relationships, we hopefully create trust, or at least get the information to the right person when they need it, which is what builds our relevance as well, having what people need when they need it. But one of the things you had mentioned when we were discussing this episode is the need for strong, active listening skills, which I think is probably something we all need to work on. I try to be really aware of it. But how many times have you talked to somebody and they cut you off, talked over you, kept talking as if you weren't speaking? And this has nothing to do with like gender or age or anything else. I mean, people just seem to just want to talk and not listen. So what did you learn about that in your research?
Well, another great question. Well, think about this. For most nonprofit organizations, especially at the local level, so a local nonprofit, a local chamber of commerce, and this applies to associations as well, because I know you've got a really good group of listeners from the association part of the nonprofit spectrum. Who is your typical, if you did an avatar of a prototype of a board member, who is that going to be? Probably the most influential, the most successful, top of the community leader list or top of your industry list in the association world. You're going for 5-star recruits. And those 5-star players are probably have a lot of experience, have a lot of knowledge, institutional knowledge, right? And they've got skills, and there's a reason why you ask them to be on your board. And then there's a big but. So you get these highly qualified individuals to serve on your board, but you never give them a chance to share the expertise and the experience that they have. And they feel that. So, you know, any given day or any given week when they're scheduling out at coming to your board meeting or not, or coming to your annual board retreat or whatever that is on a national level, state or national level, they've got other choices. And they, well, you know, do I really want to go to this meeting? All I hear is a bunch of reports. They don't take questions. As contrarian as I am, you know, they don't let me challenge anything. We start at the top of the hour. We end at the top of the next hour, and that's it. So they, you know, people, this is important to remember. People volunteer, and board service is a volunteer, you know, situation, right? So they volunteer to give their time, to give their talent, share their resources, because they want to make a difference. They want to feel like they're having an impact. Now, to your question, listening. If they don't feel like the executive director or the CEO or other staff or even other board members or the board chair, if they're not willing to listen to all the great ideas and opinions that they've got, how do they feel? They're going to feel like their time is being wasted.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just look for the tells. All of a sudden, they're not coming to the meetings prepared. They're not engaged in the conversation. If any conversation is allowed, they're not engaged in the conversation. They're not really, they're mailing it in. And mm-hmm. then now attendance starts slipping, and they pretty much have clocked out. So they're starting to ghost. They're ghosting the organization. And that just happens over and over and over. And that's just from, you know, the communication element, the listening element, and then the fails of effective communication starts in the very beginning in the recruitment phase. So if you've got board members not doing what they're supposed to do, you probably have the wrong board members. But whose fault is that?
Well, we're all going to blame the nominating committee in that situation. We're not going to say it's like staff guidance, but seriously, you're right. You have to get the right people. But I think even if you have the right people, to your point that you just made so well, if you're not creating the environment in which they can participate, in which they feel they can engage, in which they feel they can talk and be heard and contribute, that is, doesn't matter if you have the right people at the table, if you're not letting them do the job. And you're not creating that, if you're putting time limits to the point of like, we only get an hour and it doesn't matter once the hour's up, that's it. You can't do that. I spent over 15 years of my career as a volunteer leadership program director. And so I worked with people at all different levels. And what I'm hearing board members say is what I hear a lot of volunteers say. I'm either getting too many communications or not enough communication, or more importantly, the right communication. And if we're not giving them the right communication, that's really the definition of effective, is that the information I need? And am I getting it in a way that I can access it? So when you talked with board members about effective communication, what were some of the examples they gave? Like, did they have an example to you of what they consider an effective way to communicate?
Well, it was, it came up in the survey results that, some pretty good board members feel that quite often they feel like mushrooms. They're kept in the dark and covered with, well, you know what mushrooms are covered with in a grow house.
We'll say so, fertilizer, because this is a family show.
So the in a lot of cases, it's unfortunate, but there are nonprofit professionals who feel like, look, those board people, it's what a nuisance. And I just have to tolerate it. They're just there because I'm required to have them. But if I could do away with them, if I didn't have to fool with them, you know, they're just a pain to deal with. Well, you know, right there, you're, Okay, you know the relationship is not good.
That's right.
But if you just think about this, you could solve it. We can go a little bit deeper on the communication part. If in the very beginning, I urge organizations to get clarity on the expectations of their board members. So in the recruitment phase, you assume you've done the vetting, you've done the prospecting, and you've got a handful of candidates that you're wanting to visit with before, extending that invitation to join your board. Again, local, state, regional, national groups, it's all the same. But have the communication that and explain what the expectations for serving on your particular board are. And there's a quite a misunderstanding. Way too many people. Okay, it's a nonprofit board. I've been on 10 of them. They've got to all be the same. Well, they're not. So for your particular board, what are the expectations? And then once you communicate those, stop talking. Now you go into listening mode, the listening part of this. And Cecilia, what you want to listen for is their expectations. And then when you've both shared your expectations, the organization's expectations, their expectations for serving on the board, it might be possible that there's just not a matchup. And it's not that it's a bad situation. It's okay, you just we're not this isn't going to work out. And so in that case, you thank the individual for their interest, thank them for their time, and then you move on. You don't say, well, Cecilia doesn't really agree with how we do things. She's not quite what we want, but we really have to fill that board slot. If we don't get her, if she doesn't say yes, we're back to square one on our recruiting. So let's just go ahead and get Cecilia and we can fix her later. Well, I call those board members slot fillers because that's about all they are. Now, the fix them later, how often does it work? Okay, you're kind of thinking, okay, you're in a relationship and it's getting a little bit serious, and now there's getting to a point where both of you are willing to make a commitment to each other. And all right, we're going to continue this, but I have been looking for a while to find that perfect one. I just don't think, well, there's some faults here, and I have got some ideas where I'd like for this relationship to go in the future, but those might be a little bit too big to talk about them right now. So let me just get to the altar. Let me just get to the I do, and I'll fix them later. Well, how often do you think that ever really works out?
Yeah, that, and that is such a good point because
And it
that's
doesn't for nonprofit board members either.
it doesn't. It really doesn't. If they don't know what they're getting into, if it's not clear. That was actually one of the best compliments I ever got. I used to work at a nonprofit arts organization called Tappers with Attitude, and they have a dance studio. And we were having a meeting about what does it mean to be on the board of directors because, it was recruiting season. We invited all the people who were interested. I gave a presentation that outlined what it is we did, why we did it, why we had a board, what we expected of the board, how many hours a month we thought the board might have to contribute their time, if we were looking for money, all of those things. And at the end, there were no questions. And I said, oh, no questions. And one of the people in the meeting said, you told us everything we needed to know. That was an excellent presentation, and I'm in. So, making sure to your point that they understand everything about that experience, not like, oh, I'm just on the board and we're just going to expect you to know what to do. Not everybody's been on a board before, they don't understand the role, the responsibilities, or anything like that. So, in your research, this got me thinking about something else. So bear with me for a moment. So back in 2018, I posted something on Facebook about, I thought the IRS should require nonprofits of all types to do 1 hour board training every month, however that might be, you know, webinar, recorded webinar, whatever. But you should have to check that box off, like document retention policy and whistleblower policy. I could not believe the amount of pushback I got from nonprofit professionals on that, because they were all saying, we don't have time for that. We don't have time for that. Or my board's fine. My board doesn't need that. No, your board needs it too. And what I couldn't understand is why everybody said they didn't have time for training, but they always have time to clean up the messes that get created when people don't understand what's going on. So when you were talking with board members about their experience, did you hear anything about training, education, access to materials online so that they could keep up their own board education? Did you hear any comments like that?
Well, let me kind of reposition that.
Okay.
It's quite interesting to me that and there are a number of high level research projects and studies and that Keep Board Source is one of those. The folks out at Stanford have some great research, but there are all these studies that show, and I get this, that nonprofit professionals are just really a little put out because their board members really don't have a very high level of knowledge around their roles and responsibilities. So every time I see those, I'm wanting to be the contrarian that I tend to be, and I want to push back. And did they come in being a board expert? Probably not. Nope. And who is it that's supposed to do the proper orientation, do the proper training? Who is it that's supposed to make sure that happens? Mm-hmm. Is that an answer to your question? So there's a whole lot, unfortunately, in the world of nonprofits, where there are absolutely basic functional processes that should be happening, and professionals know they should, but the answer for the reason they don't is they just don't have time.
Mm-hmm.
Planning is another one of those things. Just, I don't want to start a whole nother tangent here, but
please do. That's what this show's all about.
All too often, nonprofit leaders say, well, no, we don't have a strategic plan, or the plan we have is like, it's years old, hasn't been updated, and we don't have time for that anyway. And okay, well, you're just winging it. And the Haas Compass Point study a few years ago on fundraising in America, this blew my mind, is almost 25% of nonprofits do not plan for their major fundraising activities or events. They just do them.
Wow.
No planning. So just think about, money is the lifeblood that keeps the organization flowing, going, right? So if you're not going to plan for how you're going to get the money that you funds that you need, is there any idea that you might be having a plan for your volunteer engagement, your volunteer program, your membership recruitment, your board development, staff development? Probably not. And so what I'm suggesting is not, I'm not saying, okay, nonprofit leaders, I know you're overworked, underpaid, understaffed. I know that. And you do great work and get great results in spite of all those obstacles. I'm saying is the way that you're approaching so many important functions like recruiting board members, your approach to board member relationships, I'm suggesting you need to look into a mirror and ask yourself, well, is the way I'm doing it working? Am I getting the results that I want? And if you just look at the title of the book, Stop the Nonprofit Board Blame Game. If what nonprofit leaders was doing worked, there wouldn't be a need for this book. but we keep running on a rinse and repeat cycle of behaviors, and they're not getting the results that we want, but we keep insisting. I'm saying again, look in the mirror. Is it possible there's some self-inflicted damage going on with a few little tweaks, a little attention, doing things differently for a different result? All of a sudden, you might just sleep better at night. You might have, instead of putting out fires every day or at every board meeting, you might actually have more positive productivity going on. So in the world of where you have so many professional challenges and in time, and just time not being enough of a commodity, here's a way to produce time. And it's also, this is important, I want to tag in, you mentioned this about, you know, an organization might be one of the fortunate ones that have a great board. I'm going to suggest, I love sports and I like following sports, and anybody who's got a favorite sports team, if they've won championships or pennants or Super Bowls or the World Series or whatever it is, they don't do it every year. And it's hard to get to the top. It's even harder to stay at the top. So your organization may have built a solid board. High five to you and congratulations to you. I'm going to suggest follow the lessons in Stop the Nonprofit Board Blame Game to make sure you and your board continue to stay at the top.
I am glad you made that point because, again, having spent my entire career in nonprofit management and working with volunteer leaders, my programs were successful because I thought about them and I talked with the leaders and I figured out what do they need in order to be successful. There were training manuals, there were regular emails. And when I say regular, it wasn't every day, it was like once a week, here's your email with everything you need to know. And it was presented in a format that they could skim it so that they could just pull out the parts they need. But you do have to be thoughtful about it. I find that kind of stunning that people who depend on fundraising don't actually plan their fundraising. That's like trying to run a garage and not advertise to people who own cars. That just doesn't make any sense to me. But we're always talking about, we don't have time for this, we don't have time for that. But it's like that old saying, you know, you don't have time to do it right, but you have time to do it again. That doesn't make any sense. Always try to do your best, right, from the beginning. And you made me think of several different quotes when you were talking about look in the mirror, you know, what role am I personally playing in these things? And one that always comes to mind is the cartoon character Pogo from the comic strip and his great quote about we have seen the enemy and it is us. Because one of the quotes that I use that I wrote myself is we are usually the architects of our own demise, whether knowingly or unknowingly. So we're creating that world that we are either succeeding in or not succeeding in, as the case may be. And then I was talking to my husband the other day about that great quote from Einstein. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over again and expecting a different result. But then we heard somebody on a TV show, on a talk show say, that's not insanity, that's stupidity to think that you're going to have a different outcome. And this brings me to another point that I talk about a lot, is that our nonprofit management structures, our governance structures, the way we build staff, the way we do things are so firmly rooted in the late 19th century, not the 20th, the 19th. We still have systems in place that were put in place before we had long distance telephones, before we could drive places easily, before we could fly places easily. And we still use those same approaches and techniques and wonder why they're not working in the 21st century. And this brings me to another question I'd like to ask you before we wrap up. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you.
And I'm not saying that you know the answer to this question, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. When you're talking with board members as you were writing your book, did any of them mention the size of the board as part of the issue? Like, some boards are really big. So did anybody bring that up in your research? You're laughing, so I'm going to say yes.
I'm laughing. I get, just because I get this question quite often. I'm not trying to duck the question, but my best answer is, and I've given this a lot of thought, my best answer is it depends.
Right.
And I'm a believer. And I know you share this approach and philosophy too, as a fellow consultant in this space, that when an organization is asking me to come in and be a resource to help them build a stronger board, I'm going to spend time listening to them. I'm going to spend time understanding them. I've got some basic principles and tactics that I use, but I'm not really reaching over to the shelf and pulling out, okay, here's the plan and you're going to get this. It's a customized plan based on the uniqueness of that particular organization. And I think it's so important. Now, I'm smiling because I'm looking over at my bookshelf. My good friend, Mary Byers, and her Race to Relevance book, which is, she's now celebrating the 10th anniversary of that book's success with an updated edition. So especially if you're in the association world, I urge everybody to get Mary's updated book. But she is a strong advocate, proponent, just champion for five board members. That's it. So maybe you five, just, and she quantifies all that and why and all that. But here's why I say it's depends. And so many associations, especially national associations, their makeup is okay, you've got to have so many members from each professional discipline within the association. You have to have so many members from each geographical part of the country. You've got to have every generation, represented. And then if you get into like local organizations like Chambers of Commerce or United Ways, they typically could have 40, 50, 60 board members. And the United Ways, I get it. Those are the people that are putting the money in. So they don't want to offend. And that's the way they all got started. Well, they have to be on the board if they're such a large contributor. And true with Chambers of Commerce. Now, there are a lot of chambers that are trying to, reduce that down. United Ways, okay, we might have 40 or 50, 60 board members, but we're going to have an executive committee of half a dozen. And that's where the true, organizational leadership is and the real decision-making is. But again, and in a local nonprofit, nonprofits have kind of a life cycle of evolution, development evolution. So typically when they start out, board members, they need board members, of course, but those board members are going to be fundraisers, they're going to be influencers, and they're going to be hands-on help. So to do an event, whatever it might be, that's where the volunteers come from. It's the board members. So you've got actually a pool of help that's there. Well, as you kind of evolutionize and move up in the spectrum of life cycle and nonprofits, okay, maybe now you've got a pool of volunteers. You don't need board members to be hands-on volunteers. You can use them in a different way. And you don't. So I think it really depends. And it's important to understand how many can you effectively manage and lead and communicate with. It's all based on expectations. You know, what your organization is expecting board members to do might be highly likely different than what the expectations for my particular organization is asking board members to do. So I think it depends, but it does need very thoughtful evaluation and consideration.
You know, I think that is an excellent point. I do think some boards get a little too big. I really kind of like Mary's position of just five, because we're only required to have three. So, you know, five can be good. But you're right. I call that the consultant answer. It depends. And I call that the consultant answer because we do need to find out the unique characteristics of every client and every organization that we work with. So, well, this has been just such a great conversation, and I'm really enjoying your book, and I encourage everybody to get a copy. And it's available on Amazon.com. You can go there and just look up Hardy's name or the name of the book and get it. But Hardy, before we wrap up, I always like to ask my guest, what is the one thought you would like the audience to take away today? And then how can they get in touch with you if they'd like to talk to you more about your book or maybe get you to sign it for them?
Well, thank you so very much. The advice that I would like to leave our audience with, Cecilia, is if you want a positive, productive, fully engaged board, treat your board as a high value asset, period. And then reach me, Hardy@HardySmith.com is my email. HardySmith.com is my website. I'm on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Love to engage and connect there, and always willing to have conversations and got thoughts and ideas and ready to travel.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining me this week. And again, everyone, the book is called Stop the Nonprofit Board Blame Game by Hardy Smith. So look it up on Amazon. Because we all need to work together. So let's figure out a good way to do it from both sides. So we have to go rogue for now, but we'll be back next time with another exciting episode. So please subscribe or follow us on your favorite podcast service so you don't miss anything. Lots of exciting conversations coming up as we move forward through 2024. If you'd like to learn more about Rogue Tulips Consulting and how we can help your organization bloom outside the box, check out our website, roguetulips.com. We have a list of our services on our services page. If you don't see exactly what you're looking for, let's talk. And if you're interested in getting some CAE education, whether you're applying for the first time or renewing your CAE, check out our education program, Rogue Tulips Education. You can find that at the501cleague.net. That used to be their name of the education program, but we're Rogue Tulips Education now. So again, 501cleague.net. We are still accepting people into our study groups through the middle of March. So if you're getting ready for the May exam, let us know. We're happy to include you. So that's it for this week. On behalf of Hardy and myself, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.